We have one case on our 10:30 docket, Bradshaw versus Sykes et al. If the clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Brett Sutton to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Craig Enoch to argue for the appellant.
All right, Mr. Cutney.
May it please the court, Brett Kutnick and Deborah Hankinson on behalf of the appellant, Betty Lou Bradshaw. This case admittedly involves a very unique procedural history that reads like a law school exam question. But there is a reason why, in making its rulings in the interpleader action, the trial court took judicial notice of its file from the underlying action, and why this court consolidated the two actions. Both actions involve the very same royalty proceeds, the same facts, and the same parties. And that is precisely why the trial court, after rendering final judgment in the underlying action, had no jurisdiction or authority to re-adjudicate any party's claim to the royalty proceeds in this case. I want to spend my time this morning discussing the three reasons why the trial court erred by exercising jurisdiction over the interpleader action and by refusing to abate that action during the pendency of Ms. Bradshaw's appeal of the underlying action. Time permitting, I then want to briefly discuss why the trial court additionally erred in granting summary judgment to the appellees on a claim that was itself barred by res judicata. The threshold jurisdictional arguments in this appeal and all the arguments that the appellees raise in response really turn on six facts that cannot be controverted. First, Raines suspended payment of the disputed royalty proceeds since the very beginning of production more than 4 years ago. Second, in the underlying action, the appellees asserted a counterclaim against Ms. Bradshaw in which they specifically asked the trial court to declare that production from oil and gas produced from the property, in other words, the very royalties we're talking about today, shall be distributed by the oil and gas lessee, that's Range, to them in accordance with the interest conveyed to them by Steadfast. Third, the trial court effectively denied that counterclaim when it rendered final judgment, disposed of all claims and all parties, and denied all relief not expressly granted. Number four, the appellees did not appeal that judgment. Number five, Ms. Bradshaw did timely appeal the judgment. She superseded it by posting a cash deposit in lieu of a bond, and her appeal is currently pending before this court. And number six, at the appellee's request, Range filed this interpleader action after Ms. Bradshaw had perfected her appeal of the underlying action. These indisputable facts form the framework for the three reasons why the trial court had no authority to decide the merits of the interpleader action. The first reason why the trial court had no authority to decide the interpleader action is that the appellees did not appeal the judgment in the underlying action, and the trial court no longer had plenary jurisdiction to alter that judgment 7 months later in March 2011. This issue, we contend, is controlled by the Texas Supreme Court's decision last year in the N. Ray Deredia case. Cite for that is 317. Southwest 3rd, 247. And the Deredia court recognized two principles that are particularly relevant here. First, the court made clear that a judgment that contains clear and unequivocal language, like that contained in the judgment in the underlying action, is final and must be given effect regardless of whether it specifically mentions a particular claim, regardless of whether any party asked the trial court to adjudicate that pending claim, and regardless of whether there was any legal basis for that adjudication. Thus, even if the trial court or the appellees did not intend for the trial court to adjudicate their live counterclaim, the judgment in the underlying action nonetheless does so. Second, the Deredia court recognized that in this scenario, it is incumbent on the party to appeal that judgment or take some other timely action in the trial court to ask the trial court to modify that judgment. In this case, the appellees failed to do so. They never asked the trial court to modify that judgment while the trial court still retained plenary jurisdiction, and they did not appeal the judgment denying their counterclaim. As a result, the trial court lacked jurisdiction to alter or modify that judgment 7 months later in the interpleader action. And I think it's telling that the appellees have never responded to Deredia or this issue in either the trial court or on appeal. Instead, they pretend as if they never asserted a counterclaim in the underlying action. They did. And if they believed that they were entitled to the disputed royalty proceeds, they should have done something about it, that judgment in the underlying action, to preserve their supposed right to those proceeds. They failed to do so, and it was too late for the trial court to do anything about the situation in March of 2011, when it rendered judgment in the interpleader action and inconsistently ordered the royalty proceeds to be distributed to them. Now, the second reason why the trial court was required to grant Ms. Bradshaw's motion to dismiss or motion to abate is that this court has exclusive jurisdiction over the matters at issue in the underlying action in connection with Ms. Bradshaw's pending appeal of the underlying action. In the Atkins v. Snyder case from this court, the site's 597 Southwest 2nd 779, this court recognized that once an appeal is perfected, an appellate court has exclusive jurisdiction, and that the perfection of an appeal terminates the authority of the lower court pending the appeal, so that the lower court may not thereafter proceed in the cause, at least as to the subject matter of the appeal. As this court may recall from the oral argument of the underlying action held in October, Ms. Bradshaw's pending appeal of the underlying action challenges, among other issues, the trial court's summary judgment on her claim for a constructive trust over the very same royalty proceeds that we're talking about today, and the summary judgment on her fraudulent transfer claim, which seeks to actually void the conveyances where Steadfast conveyed the royalty interest to the appellees. The validity of these claims and any right Ms. Bradshaw has to the disputed royalty proceeds are the very subject matters that the trial court allowed the appellees to relitigate in the interpleader action over Ms. Bradshaw's objections. Your Honor, I think the problem with that argument is that they are treating this case as if it is an ordinary interpleader action. And I think the problem with their argument is that they also didn't object to those funds being placed in it, and that's why those funds, our real argument here is that once those funds were in the court's registry, the trial court was powerless to do anything with it while this court still had jurisdiction, while Ms. Bradshaw's supersedious bond was still in place over the underlying judgment. And so all the cases that they cite are cases in which there is an issue that arises with respect to who owns funds and somebody places them in the court's registry. And in those cases, obviously the court has to decide who gets them. None of those cases involve the unique situation here where the parties have litigated that very issue in a separate action that was before the interpleader action. Your Honor, there are no facts that will mirror this case. And I agree that this is a case of somewhat first impression. But we think the fundamental principle, even in the cases that they cite, one of the keys is that the issue with respect to the ownership of the funds was collateral to the underlying case. And it didn't affect the judgment in the underlying case. And in this case, we have the exact opposite, because the issue over the ownership was not collateral to the underlying action. It was an issue that was actually in both sides' pleadings and that the trial court rendered a judgment on. Now, to be sure, the trial court said nobody gets it. And that's why, at least, we appealed that judgment. No, all the funds, to my knowledge, have now been withdrawn from the registry of the court, and Range, under the judgment, is currently paying those funds directly to the appellees without any court intervention. The third reason why the trial court erred in adjudicating the appellees' claimed entitlement to the disputed royalty proceeds is that Ms. Bradshaw superseded the adverse judgment rendered against her in the underlying action. Although it was docketed as a separate cause number, the interpleader action was nothing more than an effort by the appellees to enforce and execute upon the judgment in the underlying action. And you don't have to take my word for it, because this is what the appellees argued in the trial court. On page 83 of volume 1 of the clerk's record, in response to Ms. Bradshaw's motion to dismiss, the appellees argued, a trial court has an affirmative duty to enforce its judgments, that the prevailing party has a statutory right to obtain execution of that judgment, and that absent the filing of a supersedious bond, the trial court has no discretion to suspend enforcement of a final judgment. At the February 3rd, 2011 hearing on Ms. Bradshaw's motion to dismiss, the appellees again argued, it's an abuse of discretion for you, referring to the trial court, not to enforce your judgment. And in their motion for summary judgment, appellees asserted that they were entitled to issuance of execution to enforce the judgment in their favor in the underlying action, and that Texas courts have an affirmative duty to enforce their judgments. Those statements are at 1 CR 107 and 109. The fundamental problem with these arguments is that Ms. Bradshaw did in fact supersede the judgment in the underlying action. Under Rule 24.1A and 24.1C1, Ms. Bradshaw posted a cash deposit in lieu of a supersedious bond in January 2011, and the district clerk acknowledged receipt of that deposit. That can be found at tab 7 of the appendix to appellant's brief. I think it's important that no party has ever filed a motion challenging that deposit. No court has ever invalidated that deposit. And under Rule 24.1F of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, the posting of that supersedious should have immediately suspended any attempt to enforce the judgment in the underlying action. That rule unambiguously provides that enforcement of a judgment must be suspended if the judgment is superseded. And in the In Re City of Cresson case, which was authored by Justice Livingston, this court recognized the well-settled principle that any action in disregard of supersedious is contempt of the court in which an appeal is pending, and that a party or trial court has no authority to ignore the effect of supersedious or to enforce a judgment that has been superseded. Because the trial court and the appellees completely disregarded the effect of Mrs. Bradshaw's supersedious in this case, the judgment must be reversed for this reason as well. My response is, we have never claimed that we are entitled to the title to the royalty proceeds themselves. But we have not done anything to force them to put money into the court or pre-garnish or to garnish money that they have. The money that's at issue, if you remember, was suspended 4 years ago by Range. So the money, until recently, has never been in their possession. And that money was being kept because of this dispute between who is entitled to these proceeds. And our position is simply, if Steadfast had fulfilled its fiduciary duty and negotiated for a market value lease, we would have been entitled to a 1/8, or it would have been a quarter royalty, we would have got our 1/8. We didn't get that because Steadfast instead decided to self-deal and line its own pockets with a bonus, which incidentally they then gave to the appellees. And so the appellees are kind of, I guess, double dipping. They want the best of both worlds. They want the bonus and they want the royalty. And so our claim is over just the royalty proceeds themselves under this particular lease. We don't claim that we would be entitled to royalty proceeds under any other lease if this lease expires, or if this lease is reformed, we don't claim that we're entitled to the actual royalty interest itself.
I have a follow-up question to sort of your first point when talking about the final judgment that was rendered in the initial case. I'm looking at the one that's behind tab 6 called final judgment with case number ending 7009. It talks about these 6 pending motions, and the order says that motions 1 through 5 have merit and shall be granted, and then it orders that those shall be granted. And listed in those, number 5 is order granting defendant Steadfast second motion for summary judgment. Why does that not, does that not include their counterclaims?
No, they never did anything with respect to their counterclaims. When they moved for summary judgment, their second motion for summary judgment was solely a motion that said we did not breach any duty to Ms. Bradshaw, and that was kind of the main subject of the appeal. Nothing was ever done with respect to their counterclaim in the underlying action.
Okay, when you come back up to rebuttal, I'd like you to comment on the chart on page 3 of their brief.
Thank you, Mr. Cutnick. Mr. Enoch.
May it please the court. My name is Craig Enoch. Mr. Steelheimer has represented the Sykes family throughout this litigation, has asked me to argue on their behalf. Mr. Vile has always represented himself and has always filed his own pleadings in this case, but he has also asked me to represent his interests in this case. This is an interpleader action. Under North Shore is an example of a case we cited to you, but the cases are fairly uniform. In fact, I've not found a case that is inconsistent with that, that an interpleader action is actually two litigations that are serially prosecuted. The first litigation is determined as interpleader appropriate. The second litigation is any claimant who has asserted a right to those funds, have they proven their entitlement to those funds? In the interpleader, is the interpleader appropriate? That's our point about having not appealed the judgment that discharges Range. In the interpleader action, Range is the plaintiff. Range initiates the action, and Texas law permits a party like Range to use interpleader when Range does not want to be pilloried for liability for possessing somebody else's property. So Range takes the jurisdiction of the trial court, deposits the money into the court, and there's a determination. Is this appropriate for interpleader? No party objected to the interpleader. The court rendered a judgment discharging Range from any further litigation on its liability. And all that's left is the second litigation. Does anybody own these funds? The trial court had jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, of interpleader. The Modesco case that we cite to the court talks in depth about what is this jurisdiction question. And they talk about it in the context of interpleader. And the court says, you get jurisdiction because of the subject matter, interpleader. And once you have interpleader, the trial court always has jurisdiction to exercise control and determine what happens to the funds. There is no case that says that's not the case, and none has been cited. In terms of whether the second phase now, a claimant, proven ownership of the funds in the account, we now move to what happened after that discharge. The Sykes family are a set of royalty owners, and Mr. Vile is a set, has his own royalty out there. They both came forward, and with an unchallenged chain of title, in evidence, in the clerk's record, established that their royalty traces back to 1960, when Mrs. Bradshaw's parents sold all of the real estate, all of the mineral interests, and simply reserved one half of royalty. And that one half of royalty Miss Bradshaw still has. Miss Bradshaw is still being paid for it. It's never been taken from her, and she continues to have it. In the trial court, in the interpleader, Miss Bradshaw did not assert a claim to these funds, and in fact disavowed and continues to disavow she has any interest in the royalty title that the Sykes have or Mr. Vile has. And more to the point, in Alamo National Bank, a case they do not challenge, the cash realized from the royalties is the equivalent of the royalty. This cash on account in the court is the proceeds derived directly from Mr. Sykes and his family's royalties and Mr. Vile and his royalties.
Were Sykes and Vile two of the parties in the original case that had the counterclaim for declaratory relief that they were entitled to receive the disputed royalty?
Yes, Your Honor.
They were.
Okay. But, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I believe that's correct. Yes, they were. But I want to point out the court. Remember, the parties in this interpleader, the plaintiff is Range, that has liability to a claimant. And Range is allowed to escape the liability by paying the funds into the registry of the court, and the claimant proves title. In the other litigation, Miss Bradshaw was the plaintiff who sued Steadfast and then the royalty owners, and she claimed against them she was entitled to establish a constructive trust.
But you had a counterclaim for declaratory relief.
A counterclaim to Miss Bradshaw, not to Range. We had no claims to Range. To Miss Bradshaw, our counterclaim says we don't owe her the money. We're entitled to the money. In fact, and we'll get to this, because the Supreme Court has specifically recognized those circumstances, as between co-defendants, there is no obligation for the co-defendants to sue each other, and there is no res judicata effect of their failure to having sued each other. In the interpleader, the claim was not against Miss Bradshaw. The claim was against Range that was holding the funds. And Miss Bradshaw, the competing counterclaim, was not brought by Mr. Vile. Understand, Mr. Vile didn't bring any counterclaim. The Sykes group brought a counterclaim. It was in response to her claim she was entitled to the money. And the Supreme Court has even spoken directly to that, Your Honor. In Dick Matz, the Supreme Court issued a per curiam opinion when the Court of Appeals dealt with a declaratory judgment by an insurance agent claiming that the agency owed him more commissions. The trial court rendered a take-nothing judgment on that express claim that I want a declaration that I'm owed more commissions. The Supreme Court, in a very unusual move, issued a per curiam opinion. In its per curiam opinion, it affirmed the Court of Appeals judgment, but it issued a writing: do not interpret the Court of Appeals determination that the declaratory judgment by ruling take nothing meant that the agent was not entitled to his commissions. Later on, the Supreme Court writes in Martin versus Richard, when you have a declaratory judgment that is defensive to a claim by the plaintiff, the denial of the declaratory judgment is not the same thing as a finding or a conclusion that the subject matter of that declaration was against the declarant. In other words, this court's denying all the relief requested and not otherwise granted on their declaration that Ms. Bradshaw does not have a claim against them and they have a claim to the funds is not a finding against them that they have no claim to the funds. It is simply a denial of the declaration, which could be for any reason, as an example, no necessity. When the claim that was tying up the funds was denied, overruled, there's no necessity for the court to go further and say, okay, now, Sykes, you can get the money. More to the point, going back to who are the parties. Range was a co-defendant. Range possessed the funds, and Range held the funds. And as co-defendants, there's no requirement for co-defendants to sue each other, and there's no res judicata effect from their failure to sue each other when they're dealing with claims brought by a plaintiff. In interpleader, the true plaintiff is the person possessing the funds. And the true proof is, do I establish ownership to the funds? Ms. Bradshaw never brought a claim to those funds, and in fact specifically disavows those funds. Let's talk about the superseding issue. The court has already dealt with that preliminarily on the superseding of the judgment. Judge Gabriel asked, do you have any cases that are anywhere close? And the response was, there are no cases about this unique circumstance. Admittedly, it's an unpublished opinion, but the courts have recognized the reality for what value their analysis is. The court can consider it. The Hearn case. In the Hearn case, it is exactly this. One party brought a claim against another party for proceeds. They lost on their main claim. The funds, by the person possessing it, put it into the registry of the court, and it went up on interpleader. And almost all of these same issues were raised. And in particular, superseding the other judgment somehow made this interpleader an enforcement. Hearn answers that question. Appellants, Ms. Bradshaw, has not been ordered to transfer any money or property to anyone. They have not been enjoined, either temporarily or permanently, nor have they been ordered to take any action by the interpleader court. We find that for the purposes of this interpleader action, appellants were not judgment debtors and had no absolute right to suspend the judgment. The argument there is, wait a minute, this interpleader, they're going to distribute the funds. And Hearn goes in and says, but wait a minute, you made no claim to the funds. How are you being harmed by not having those funds? Again, Hearn answers these, but so does North Shore. North Shore answers these, and together they dispose of all the issues. There's ample authority underlying both cases. Bradshaw cannot claim an interest in these funds. They are royalties. And the courts have ample authority. She says, well, order to be paid back into the court. Well, they don't have any authority to say to do that. And Mijah versus Jensen doesn't even say to order it back. They just simply say, if money's gone to the wrong people, you can get a judgment for restitution, or the trial court can explore it. This court has dealt with that in the AMX case, and they've cited Mijah, but there's nothing that says this court ought to go ahead and order that the funds be returned. And Judge Gabriel raised the question, and we pose it. We think the public policy has actually been expressed by the legislature on exactly this unique circumstance that they're arguing about. It's prejudgment garnishment. They say, well, because Range always held the money, that makes this different. Well, garnishment is always against a third-party holder of the money. Garnishment would have been against Range. But the legislature has said, when you've got a tort plaintiff, when it's a tort plaintiff, you can get garnishment after you have a judgment, and after you show that the defendant has no assets in Texas, or so little assets in Texas, you run the risk of your judgment not getting paid. True, they made a claim against Range. It is not true that this was voluntary. Under the Natural Resources Code, Chapter 91, Range had the authority to withhold the payment of the royalties so long as somebody claimed title. During the course of that other litigation, Ms. Bradshaw disavowed title. And at the end of that litigation, she lost on her claim of a constructive trust, not title, constructive trust. At that point, Chapter 91 doesn't apply. There's no claim of title, competing claim of title. They deposit interpleader in the court. Who comes forward to prove their entitlement? The owners of the royalty, which is the proceeds. Ms. Bradshaw didn't have any competing claim. And they come to tell you this is unique. There's not been any other case like this. North Shore deals with exactly this kind of problems. Hearn dealt with the almost identical facts to this. And I want to point out, in re Derrida, the court, what the lawyers tried to do is get a nunk-pro-tunk. American Express had a claim against both parties, forgot about one, got a default on the other, and then said all relief not granted is denied. And American Express came in and tried to change that judgment to reflect, oh, we really wanted to go to trial against this other defendant. And the Supreme Court said, it's final. Every case that they rely on, we can agree with the principles expressed. It's just, when you're talking about a defensive declaratory judgment against Mr. Bradshaw, the Supreme Court said, that isn't a res judicata level pleading. Mr. Vile didn't even have it, but the Supreme Court also says, in the context of interpleader, not the uniform, the courts of appeals, in the context of interpleader, say, it's not this dispute that controls. Have you proved your ownership of the asset? And if only one does, as Noshar says, in summary judgment, as we have our unchallenged chain of title, they don't even claim title, summary judgment is appropriate for the distribution of funds. I believe the trial court judgment in this case should be affirmed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Enoch. Mr. Kutnick, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The only difference between this case and the underlying action with respect to the dispute at royalty proceeds is who's holding the money. In the underlying action, Range was holding the money, and now in the interpleader action, the trial court is holding the money. But what they are doing is collaterally attacking the judgment from the underlying action, asking the trial court to usurp this court's jurisdiction and disregarding a supersedeas that prevents enforcement of that judgment by asking the trial court to give them that money. And the problem we have here is that there is a possibility of completely inconsistent judgments. In fact, we have inconsistent judgments right now. We have one judgment in the underlying action which says nobody gets the money. And if, depending on what happens on the appeal of the underlying action, we have the possibility that the transfer of the royalty interest to the appellees may be voided for being fraudulent. We have the possibility that Ms. Bradshaw may be given a right to those proceeds under constructive trust theory. And in the meantime, we have another judgment in this case, which is awarding them that money. And so because the whole threshold issue is who does this money belong to, the trial court had no decision to make in this case once it took the money into its registry. And let me clear up the record. We did object to that. And we told the trial court, you should not be accepting this money. We did object. We have not separately appealed that action because that action doesn't harm us. There's really no difference to us whether the money is being held by Range or the court. But what we said in that circumstance is that this, to the trial court, is that under this circumstances, you have to abate. You've got to wait for the underlying action appeal to be finished. There's a supersedious bond in place. You can't do anything with respect to that underlying judgment during the appeal and while that supersedious bond is pending. I want to talk about a few of the arguments we heard. We heard a lot about a defensive declaration. And Your Honors, this is not a defensive declaration. I invite you to read their counterclaim because when they asserted their counterclaim, if you recall, this is at a point when Range had already suspended payment of the money. And they asked the trial court specifically, they asked the trial court several things. They wanted the court to construe various deeds in a lease. They asked the trial court to declare that production from that lease should be paid to them. They also asked the trial court to declare that Ms. Bradshaw defend and indemnify them because they claimed that she was breaching a warranty of title. And they asked the trial court to award them attorney's fees. In fact, if you look at some of the cases on the defensive declaration that they cite a case called BHP Petroleum v. Millard from the Texas Supreme Court. I think what's interesting is in that case, the Texas Supreme Court discusses another case, Winslow v. Acker from San Antonio, which we discuss in our reply brief, and it's almost the mirror image of this case. In that case, you had a plaintiff, a non-executive, who was suing to for royalties. The defendant filed a counterclaim for declaratory judgment and said that the royalties were them. And the court said that that is not a defensive declaratory action, that that action can stand on its own. And that's what we have here. And that's why once the trial court rendered judgment in the underlying action denying their counterclaim, they had to do something about it.
How do you respond to their position, though, that Bradshaw has abandoned any kind of claim on the funds based on royalty and title?
We have not. Our position has always been we're not trying to take the title to themselves. And I think this also goes to Justice McCoy, your issue with respect to the chart. And I know it's a little complicated. But one of the things the court needs to recall is that the property that we're talking about is about a 2,000-acre property. Ms. Bradshaw only has, her interest is limited to about 1,800 acres. So there's an extra 200 acres that we've never claimed any interest in. We're not trying to take any proceeds from it. As far as we know, all the proceeds from those royalties have continued to be paid to the appellees over the time. What we are simply saying is that because of the breach of duty, at least with respect to our constructive trust claim, the proceeds under this lease, and this lease only, there should be a trust placed on that for Ms. Bradshaw's benefit, because that is what she's been deprived of by the wrongdoing that we say that Steadfast engaged in. And you know, I think this would be an easier case. If Steadfast simply kept that royalty for itself, I think it's easier to understand why the wrongdoer themselves shouldn't get both the royalty proceeds and the bonus. We don't think they should be in a better position just because Steadfast distributed those monies.
Okay, I haven't heard the answer to the question. I have two questions. First of all, I haven't heard your comment on this chart on page 3. It basically says it really isn't going to make any difference if you're entitled to an eighth or a quarter. Their interest stays the same, so it's of no moment. Do you agree with that?
Mathematically, I agree with that, but I think the fundamental problem is, and I think it goes back to the same point, is what they're trying to do is get the best of both worlds. They want to have, they want to take all the benefits from their self-dealing and the bonus that was distributed to them, and they want the royalty proceeds. If Steadfast had negotiated for a quarter royalty, we wouldn't be here today saying that this... Under their title, yes. But whether they have an interest, because again, that's one of the issues that's being litigated in the underlying action with respect to our fraudulent transfer claim, because part of that is trying to void that transfer.
If you're trying to argue a constructive trust that owns those proceeds, you made no claim to the proceeds because?
But we've always made a claim to the proceeds. What we've said is we are not claiming title. We are not trying to take their title away from them.
I'm talking about title. Talking about the money range put in the registry of the court.
Yes.
You made no claim on those funds, not royalty interests, but funds themselves.
I think that's incorrect factually, but I think it misses the whole central point of our argument in this case, which is the trial court didn't have jurisdiction to relitigate that issue. And so our position was simply, Your Honor, we've already made the claim to those funds in the underlying action. You've already taken judicial notice of those funds.
In that they were held by Range, and you were claiming against Range. So you're trying to say that the funds are just moving around, and we've already made a claim to the funds regardless of their possessor.
That's correct. And our whole point was, if this court doesn't have jurisdiction to decide these issues, why should we be in here arguing against ourselves and then relitigating that issue? And if you look at
you could also say, if you came in and alleged some sort of interest in the fund, you would be acknowledging the jurisdiction of the court.
I don't think we could waive that argument, but I think procedurally you have to look at the way procedurally what happened is we moved to abate. After we moved to abate, they moved for summary judgment. Those things were heard on the same day, and so what happened is instantaneously the court denied our abatement and then granted them summary judgment. But if you also look in the reporter's record, I think it's in volume I believe it's volume 2 or volume 3, pages 33 and 34. There is a discussion between the Appellee's counsel and Ms. Bradshaw's counsel in which they say, we want Ms. Bradshaw to say whether she's asserting a claim to these funds. And Mrs. Bradshaw's counsel said, yes, we've only been doing that since 2007. We continue to do that and say that those are our funds, not the other side's funds.
All right, Mr. Kutnick, thank you. Thank you also, Mr. Bates, Mr. Moe, and Ms. Hankinson. We appreciate you being here and your arguments and briefing. Mr. Enoch and Mr. Seelheimer, thank you for being here today. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing. Your case is now submitted, and we will adjourn court.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.
Okay. Very good. Give us a minute. That's your family. Cut, cut, cut.